for coming today. We are short one board member for a quorum, and we are actually expecting that we are going to remain short one board member. But we're going to wait just a few more minutes to see if Dr. Singh made a miracle recovery overnight on herself. And then after less than 5 minutes from now, we'll get the board meeting started, and we will let you all know how we are going to deal with everything on the agenda. So have fun for another few minutes. I think we'll go ahead with the roll call, please, Mary, and then we'll proceed.
Mr. Eliopoulos?
Here.
Mr. McGrath?
Here.
Mr. Moore?
Here.
Dr. Singh? Dr. Young?
Here. Thank you. We do not have a quorum today. So perhaps the first thing we could do is to have Bruce and Yuri advise us as to which items on the agenda we can go ahead with without a quorum and which we should postpone.
You can jump in.
And while she's getting set up, let me just say that we apologize for not being able to let you folks know earlier. We didn't know until a few minutes ago, so otherwise we would have tried to contact you all.
I do not have good news. Unfortunately, since we do not have a quorum, that severely hampers what the board can do. The board cannot hear, deliberate, or act on any item on the agenda. So the matter should be continued. In the past, sometimes when we've had meetings, we've convened into two workshops to informally just hear certain things that are in the record. Perhaps we can do that with respect to the EO report.
And
we also,
Bruce, do you have anything to add?
Plan to present some staff awards, and certainly that's something I think we can and, yeah, and should do. But the message here is that at sometimes when we've had board meetings and a member has left and we've lost a quorum, that we've been able to hear some things in workshop. Here we can't really even even start to hear items. So that essentially means that item 3, the minutes, item 4, the Save the Bay 50th anniversary, item 6, and item 7, we'll have to continue all of those to next month.
Yes, will it be next month, or is there any item on the agenda that you think will take more than next month to bring back?
I know that the City of Richmond has passed a motion directing its staff to request an extension on, this is on Point Mulati, item 7, extension
of 60
days.
Just got one for a month.
And so we'll try to find out more about that and see whether it's appropriate to do that item in November or December.
All right. And the rest we will reschedule for November. My apologies to you all. We're all looking forward to saying nice things about Save the Bay, and now we get to have another month to think about exactly what it's going to be. And we will, of course, look forward to dealing with the other items on the agenda when they're rescheduled. So thank you all, and our apologies.
With that,
but you're welcome to stay and hear the staff awards, because they're going to be they're very, very impressive.
Yeah. With that, I suggest that we proceed with the staff awards, the Sustained Superior Achievement Awards.
That would be my pleasure. These awards are given every year, but they are on the basis of work that has been done for at least 2 years, and that's why we call them the Sustained Superior Achievement Awards. Um,
What's going on behind me? Are we going to have a presentation?
No, we're just just sort of deleting things there.
Got it. So we are fortunate to have, we have such a great staff here that we actually get to have two awards. We get to give two awards this year, one to Brian Wines and one to Keith Roberson. And what I'd like to do is actually read what the award says and what's on the plaque, and because it's quite lovely. The San Francisco Bay Regional Water Quality Control Board and the State Water Resources Control Board are giving a certificate of appreciation to, in this case, Brian Wines and Keith Roberson. And the text is that this sustained superior accomplishment award is presented to you for outstanding job performance over and above normal job expectations over a period of not less than 2 years. Your exemplary work and dedication is greatly appreciated. We thank you, and may you continue to be a model and an example for all. And these plaques are signed with our chairman's name, John Mueller, and the executive officer, Bruce Wolf. And they're very pretty. I'll show them to you in a minute. But first I want to say a couple of words in addition about the work that both Brian and Keith have been doing. Brian is in charge of all of the water quality certifications for Alameda and Santa Clara counties. This work, as you know, involves a great deal of technical detail, a lot of time juggling, and a lot of the capacity to make people in Alameda and Santa Clara counties either very happy or very angry. And the word is that Brian has been doing such a good job that he is able to maintain our water quality standards, which I'm proud to think are some of the highest in the state, but do so in a way that is very efficient, not only for his time and for the regional board's time, but also very kind is the word that comes to mind for the folks who are on the receiving end. And one of the ways that he's been doing that is to have an electronic boilerplate water quality certification with a whole lot of wide choice of options. It's kind of like build your own car, you know, when you go to the websites of the car companies. You build your own water quality certification, and that provides certainty to people, and that's a very good thing. It also helps to streamline, I'm sure, our own activities. And this is only one of the things that Brian is doing. And he was recognized for this great work by his peers, who are the ones who originally will provide names to Bruce and to the State Board for these awards. In Keith's case, Keith is one of the most senior engineering geologists at the board and has overseen several site cleanups. One of the biggest ones that that he's been on for more than a decade, is the 5,000-acre United Technologies Corporation site in San Jose. One of the major issues there is perchlorate, and I'm sure everyone in this room recognizes that just saying the word perchlorate causes explosions all over the internet and red flags go up all over.
In more ways than one.
Dealing with a site of this size with that particular contaminant, especially, keeping it on track, getting the job done, keeping everybody relatively happy requires not only a lot of technical expertise, but pretty good diplomatic skills as well. And he's also done some media work on the site, and since we haven't heard anything bad about that, I'm grateful to say it must have been very, very successful. He also oversees other sites, one of which was the Sportsman's Peninsula Sportsman's Gun Club in Menlo Park, and it was important to clean up that site in a both a rigorous and a very efficient way, because the South Bay Salt Pond restoration depended on us or on someone getting that site cleaned up first. So in both cases, for Brian and for Keith, these folks have done fabulous work. They're emblematic of the kind of work that we always appreciate seeing from board staff, and I'm very pleased to be able to present these plaques, and because we don't often get to put our money where our mouth is, I will also mention that they each get $250 to go with the plaque, so that's great.
All right.
Please come up.
A low tech as well.
Nice camera. Somebody get some beer.
Beer might not fix it, but you really can.
We appreciate your service, and I've heard about a good support. And this is Keith, diplomat. I'm so pleased for you. All righty.
I love being at this board.
Of course, now that you've spilled the beans that they got $250, all the staff are going to be flocking to them for payday loans. But
That's right. Or buy me coffee.
Yes, yeah,
certainly. But well-deserved, definitely.
Yes. All right, we cannot do the minutes because that requires a vote. So I think we should go on to the board member reports. And we do have a lot of them. It's been a busy month for the board members. And Jim, would you like to start?
Okay. Thank you, board members. And thanks for everybody for attending, and congratulations to our staff, of which we are very proud. And as Acting Chair Young mentioned, it's been a busy month for us. We've attended a lot of events, and I'm going to focus on one because we shared some time. Of course, I'll mention that I was at the State of the Estuary Conference, and that was a great event. Of the ones that I've attended, one of the most impressive technically, and just the quality of the presentations and the panels. And just showing us how much more work we need to do, but how much we've accomplished. You know. But moving on to my main report, there's an area of the Bay that I've have a lot of interests in, personally, professionally, and then also from a standpoint of being a water board member, is the North Bay. And I was made aware when I attended the Skaggs Island ceremony of a process that Caltrans has begun, and they call it a stewardship study. And what that is they're attempting to bring in stakeholder input into the reconfiguration of Highway 37, State Highway 37, between the cities of Novato and Vallejo. And so, yeah, everyone should have a map in their mind about that corridor. And if you think about our agendas in the last year, how many of our items have touched that corridor, whether it was recently Cullinan Ranch or, there were not long ago there was the Napa, the old Napa plant site for salt making was permitted about a little over a year ago. And all these areas that in some way are touched on or affected by the management of the transportation corridor that crosses it. And so, as a board member, primarily, I was very interested in attending and seeing how this process was being integrated or coordinated with the multiple items that we've worked on here, you know, Skaggs Island, Collin Ranch, the former salt ponds, the Napa-Sonoma Marsh, the idea of using recycled water to dilute bittern, all of these things. And I'm just struck by how much in common, technically, scientifically, this issue, this planning issue, has with many themes touched upon at the State at the Estuary Conference. Even in the plenary session, when we discussed ways to rate the health, let's say, of the estuary. And, you know, I think of Josh Collins's presentation there where he said, well, we can look at such indicators as tidal marsh size, tidal mudflats size, size distribution, and then and how we're doing pretty well on the small pieces of tidal marsh. But when it comes to the very large contiguous and connected pieces, we've lost those, anything over 5,000 acres. And you think of the work we're doing up there in the North Bay in connecting that system to the estuary. And what is the biggest, you know, we say the elephant in the room? State Highway 37 is a dam that blocks the connectivity of the San Pablo Bay system to those marshes that we've gotten into public ownership, and we're struggling to come up with restoration projects to make sure that highway keeps being functional. So I think it's just a very important process for us to be involved in, and I was happy to participate and bring these interests forward about how important it is to rethink it. And it's such a great opportunity, too, for the region from the potential for win-win. You know, it's an expensive proposition to reconfigure that transportation corridor for all the important economic reasons. It's also, and so it will be expensive, it will be costly, no matter what alternative is considered. So it is an opportunity to combine forces, to join forces, let's say, with transportation interests, and to join forces as those that have estuary interests. And, you know, I have a philosophically, I believe wetlands and that sort of, you know, those functions that they provide the estuary are part of our clean water infrastructure. You know, not a very romantic word. It's kind of ridiculed these days. But having these processes of the estuary enhanced along with transportation infrastructure, I think, is an elegant combination. So thanks for listening to those philosophical points. I would just point out that the process has been going on for about 4 months, and Caltrans, through working with UC Davis, has done a good job of getting the proper interests at the table. We have the cities, sanitary districts, farmers, land managers, fish and game, fish and wildlife, environmental interests, local and state transportation planners, the Bay Trail advocates for bicycles and pedestrians. There was good representation of scientists that have the interests in estuary in mind, but also the feasibility restoration and all those issues that come up. So the alternatives that are being considered are appropriate, maybe a little wide. It was interesting because, just to give you some insight into the latest stakeholder process, or in the reports out from the groups of people that assembled at tables and talked about things with maps on tables and drawing things and considering permitting issues that we would have. That corridor between Highway 121 and the Napa River Bridge, there seemed to be coalescing a vision that was fairly harmonious in terms of a vision of an elevated causeway with four lanes that would allow for much more connectivity to the bay. And so I think there was very little minority opposition. It had to do, understandably, with those that would want to preserve the agricultural heritage in that area. But the agriculture is below sea level, and it is on not the optimum soils. So that's emerging. This concept of it being segmented, And but very interesting to learn about how the ports of Stockton and Sacramento are growing and how this 37 corridor has become economically important to the region for freight, and how there's an economic driver to improve this roadway. Because as you know, it's two lanes in between 121 and Napa River Bridge. So I know it's a long report, but I'm excited to see it being contemplated, because as a user of the highway, it's always been a challenge too. All right, thank you.
Are there any questions of Steve?
Oh, yes, I wanted to open up questions for the board. Sorry, I did intend to encourage discussion.
Has he been sworn? Or? thanks for that report, Stephen. And I'm going to leave a substantial part of this to Dr. Young. But it has been a busy month. I'll just tick off the meetings that I think had some relevance. The first was the breaching of the dikes at the Eden Landing Restoration Project. That's a little bit north of where we have to worry the most about mercury accumulation, but restoring wetlands in an area that's been compromised with metal that is so severe that we have TMDLs and monitoring is a challenge and a wonder. There was the State of the Estuary Conference, which was wonderful this year and really educational. There was the Water Quality Coordinating Committee meeting up in Sacramento, which made it clear to me that over the next couple of years, we're going to be dealing with changes in not just water quality, but the eventual water supply issues as the modifications to water policy in the legislation passed a couple of years ago become clear, and even areas in the Bay Area have to begin to reduce their reliance on imported water and begin to look at groundwater. So it ties into what we're doing in cleanups, and it ties into having the necessary geological expertise on our staff to begin to think about conjunctive use. That's the take-home message from the water. And then the Regional Monitoring Program annual meeting, where we're continuing to making progress. But I wanted to comment just on a couple of things. The other effort was, as I am the regional board's appointee to BCDC, and this year they adopted amendments to their Bay plan to deal with climate change. Now, contrary to some of the controversy about that, BCDC doesn't have authority to deny any project within their shoreline band because it's at risk of flooding from sea level rise, and they're not seeking that authority. Instead, what they're proposing is a collaborative planning effort begin to grapple with the flooding issues and the bay fill issues associated with 14 inches or more of sea level rise over the next 50 years. And that does tie into much of what we do. It was nice to see the kind of collaborative work and negotiating work that arrived at a unanimous vote. But I think it relates much to what Steve has said about the South Bay and our work in watershed and stream preservation and low-impact development. One of the things that I'd like to point out to people that don't look at things with a shoreline morphology hat, the 200 or so yards of land outboard of Highway 37 in the railroad corridor along the North Bay is not natural land. It's accreted land from two different sources. The huge volume of hydraulic mining material that was discharged to the bay beginning about 1880, and the construction of a very long jetty at the mouth of the Carquinez Strait in the Napa River, which tends to hold that in place. Now, the leading edge of that of those accreted wetlands is starting to erode. So there are both resources involved and there are contaminants of the legacy down in there. So managing this resource, which is an artifice of human intervention with rising sea level and dealing with the necessary infrastructure is challenging. Many people look at an environment like that that looks so natural and is in fact a habitat for endangered species, and they don't realize that it's not what it was when the gold rush started. So we have to deal with these things not with merely a water quality hat, but with a multidisciplinary hat that looks at things in that way. So I don't forget who it was said, when you pull on something, you find it's kind of connected to almost everything else. It's too true. So that's my report.
No, nothing to report.
I saw you at all those meetings. You can at least tell us where you were.
WUCC and the San Francisco Estuary. I enjoyed it very much. Learned a lot. That's it.
It's always a man of few words and much thinking. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
I did, Steve, want to ask you a question.
Yeah.
Were you a voice in the wilderness at these meetings talking about connectivity, or is, I think what you said at the end was that people were beginning to coalesce around the kind of vision that I would expect to come from this board and from restoration folks. Is that correct?
Yeah, and it is. It was, and unfortunately, it wasn't just me having that voice. But I was the one who took Josh Collins's quote from the plenary session, make way for the bay, with respect to sea level rise issues. And that made its way into sort of, you know, one of the take homes of what we need to reckon with. And just also I made a connection with, and I didn't hear this from Fish and Wildlife and Fish and Game, but that the recovery of large, contiguous, and connected tidal marsh is the key to removing endangered species from the endangered species list. One of the lessons in the estuary conference was these little postage stamp tidal marsh wetlands, like at Colma Creek in South San Francisco, is a good example, where they actually tagged clapper rails and found that they were going to Heron's Head Marsh in San Francisco, which was celebrated, but also across the Golden Gate to Marin County. Because at these high spring tides, with the stormwater coming in, our endangered species individuals are getting are a victim of predation because they get flushed out. So, you know, the recovery of these species isn't hinging on the Colma Creek wetlands or places like that. It's on getting them high tide refuge. And so, bringing around the multidisciplinary kind of thinking, I think, you know, I was encouraging that. I was encouraged to speak about that. But, you know, also Brendan Thompson of our staff was there and did a good job of articulating the permit details. But we have a lot of common ground with the land managers of the refuge, the fish and game experts. Carl Wilcox, who's the regional manager for Fish and Game, are very knowledgeable about restoration. I don't have to say much about that, right? He was there, too. So there was a good representation of these interests, and very constructive, too.
Well, thank you for following that and participating for it on our behalf, in it on our behalf. Okay, I will go ahead and give the chair's report, and then we'll turn it over to you if that's okay, because it blends in with everything everyone else is saying or has reported on. I was also at the State of the Estuary Conference, and one of the things that was in the highlighted in the plenary session was a report on the state of San Francisco Bay. There was a lot more there than probably met the eye of most of the people who attended and most of the people who read about it in the newspaper, because this particular State of the Estuary report built an indicator system that, if we continue to support it, will last and will be very useful for management of the bay and just for understanding it in the future. And the reason I say that is because it was grounded in an understanding of the entire ecological system, and they worked very hard to select a few indicators that would be representative of most of the really important driving structural and functional elements of the bay. They did a very good job. Mm-hmm. As I mentioned before, I was asked to be an initial pre-publication reviewer of the report. I think Tom Mumley was also asked to do the same thing, and it was a pleasure to do that and a pleasure to see it presented at the State of the Estuary Conference. Coincidentally, I'm also doing on a panel for the Washington State Academy of Sciences to review their State of Puget Sound set of indicators, which they call dashboard indicators, like looking at a car's dashboard and being able to see, you know, right away that whether your engine's too hot, that kind of thing. I thought we did a better job. I will leave it at that because the other report isn't public yet. But I was very proud of the folks who did our report. And I wonder, Bruce, if we could ask you on behalf of the board to particularly thank Judy Kelly for putting together this State of the Estuary Conference, which was just outstanding, and we all enjoyed it very much.
Yeah. Karen McDowell, of course.
Yeah. And yes, yes, thank
Excuse
you.
Me. Excuse me. Definitely, you. And I will note, I think all of you got a copy of the report. If you did not, let us know. Actually, the report was very popular. They ran out of their
they
first
did.
Run and are making another run. So I want to make sure you all get a copy if you haven't already. But we're also going to share copies with folks up in Sacramento and try to expand the understanding. And as you say, I think the report was well done and becomes a model for how to do this effectively.
I'd like to comment on that.
Yeah.
It didn't, of course, spring newborn out of anyone's head. It actually goes back to the initiation of the Estuary Project and the different kinds of elements of the project, which have been refined over the 15 or 20 years of the process, into those kinds of things that I think for the audience should be aware. It gives a scientific base way to look at what is important in the Bay and begin to focus attention. And that is very much, I think, part of the agenda of this board and the staff, to focus the regulatory effort on those things that matter the most and to try to streamline the rest so that we're not burdening people with unnecessary reporting on things that aren't the drivers. And, of course, it does start with good science, and Dr. Young's comments are very well taken.
And if there is anything that this board can do to promote the funding of the continuation of this indicator system, I would be in favor of doing that. All right, on to the WQCC meeting. We had a very good turnout. All the board members were there with the exception of John because it was during high pumpkin season. We had substantial discussions on groundwater, and with a lot of discussion about the arguments both for and against regulation and what that would mean, and looking at the science of groundwater, which is extremely interesting. And if folks want to see what it was that we were looking at and the basis for our discussion, I believe all of those documents are publicly available. The second thing that we discussed in quite a bit of detail was the possibility or the potential for or the pipe dream of, depending on who you talk to, of the regional boards increasingly stepping into the role of setting flow standards based on our water quality responsibilities. As you can imagine, it was a very interesting discussion with many points of view. So look for that. That's going to be interesting as it comes down the pike. As for the RMP, the Regional Monitoring Program annual meeting, it was also very well done, as usual. And for those of you who missed it, the plenary report was on the presentation of research about unregulated contaminants, which we sort of call emerging contaminants, even though they've emerged a long time ago. And one of the most interesting things to me was the report on the toxicity that was measured at the outlet of the Napa River, and then going back and doing a toxicity, what's the TIE stand for?
Identification.
Identification evaluation. Thank you very much. And the cause turned out to be mixtures, not any single thing. And the one of the take-home lessons there was not only that we are going to have to live in the world of mixtures very soon, which is not a surprise, but it is complicated, but also there was a very cogent explanation of why regulating water quality chemical by chemical is not going to be perhaps the most efficient way going forward, and that if we can have bioassays that will capture the effects of families of chemicals and then be able to go back and do toxicity identification evaluations, that might be the way to go in the future. And EPA is moving in this direction. A lot of people have been thinking in this direction, but actually getting there, as you all know, is going to be a big step. So,
could I ask a question?
Yes, you may.
Since I wasn't at the RMP. You touched on something profound, of course. But as you look at families of chemicals, which makes sense, you know, from a chemistry standpoint, are you also looking at families of sources? That is, do the mixtures seem to come from one source, or do they come from the whole range of human disturbance?
In the particular examples that were run through in this presentation, the TIE found and Jim, you can, and Shalom, you can jump in if I get this wrong or incomplete, found that the active ingredients, if you will, did seem to come from a particular type of source, which is associated with structural pest control and with not necessarily the active ingredients that are used in pesticides, but in the carrier chemicals. That may have just been a happy or unhappy coincidence, though. I think the thrust of the argument and the presentation was that we should be looking at bioassays that show us that there is going to be a response in the biota, work backwards in a way that looks at classes of chemicals, and if they happen to be from the same source, good, and if they don't, then the picture gets more complicated. But I think the source is sort of at the end of the logic chain rather than at the beginning, and which I think was your question.
Yeah, that's well answered.
There's a couple of different kinds of toxicity. There's persistent sediment toxicity throughout the bay, and of course the physics of settling of sediments with the associated contaminants are not really completely well understood, but they generally don't tend to be entirely driven or sometimes even primarily driven by local watersheds. The residence time of fine-grained sediment in the bay can be months or longer. So and that persists, and of course there were plenary sessions, so I'm sure that Dr. Young caught some that I missed. But in those cases, the bioassays look like pretty powerful tools. That's the part I remember. There's also a persistent signal from each of the replacement pesticides. I mean, the regional monitoring program has been telling us that for some time, that as we search for pesticides that don't have the bioaccumulation potential of the earliest ones, we find ones that persist. And while they may not have human toxicity, they're profoundly toxic to different classes of waterborne organisms. And so some of it is directly related to that. Mm-hmm. And that has, I think, guided us to a quicker turnaround about a regulatory response. But it is difficult because you're doing a little bit of a whack-the-mole on pesticides.
Yes. So far, anyway. I have one last thing, and that is that we did have an ABAG Executive Committee meeting sometime since we last met. I think it was
the September.
I guess it was the September meeting, yeah. And as has been the case for most of the executive committee meetings in the past, I'd say year or so, most of the discussion was about transportation planning and in the context of planning for where people are going to live, because there's a state law that says that all the cities have to figure out how they're going to accommodate population growth, and we're going to and they want us to do it rationally, and so we have processes to try to do that rationally, and we've been discussing that a lot. Same thing, you know, fill in the same blanks for climate change. So the two major drivers of these discussions that involve all of the cities and counties around the Bay, as you know, are trying to minimize the basically the pollution outfit of our output of our transportation system, which has to do with climate change, and then accommodating the housing needs. Water quality is down in some tier below that top tier. I'm not sure whether it's second tier or below, but I am sorry to report to you that we are not the most important game in town on these decisions, and I think we may well be just sort of looking at a set of options that have been constrained by other other considerations when we look at the water quality impacts, unlike the example of the 37 corridor, which is kind of a breath of fresh air. The other thing I wanted to let you know about ABAG is that now that Mr. Peacock is no longer on the board, he was our alternate representative to ABAG. We can't do any voting today, but we do need to
designate
new alternate, which, gosh, it looks great on your resume, and you get to come to Oakland for evening meetings, and the police chief just resigned, and but right now you can just take Bart and walk upstairs to the, you know, it's very safe. So let's give that some thought, and we'll be we'll be lassoing people sometime before the next board meeting on that one. Mm-hmm. And I think that was my report. Bruce, we'd love to hear the executive officer's report.
That was nice.
And thanks for staff bringing up that point about ABAG alternate. So we'll talk with you on that. I did want to follow up on Steve's point about the infrastructure nexus to some of our restoration, because just this week President Obama issued a directive to federal agencies to accelerate 14 infrastructure projects, one of which is called the West Coast Habitat Restoration Program, and the components in that include restoration at the Sears Point wetlands and at the Napa River salt marsh restoration, and that's tied very closely into Highway 37. The directive here really is to federal agencies to accelerate their permitting and technical input on these projects. I've already received an email on this from Alexis Strauss saying that this is high profile and that we'll want to coordinate. It will not necessarily be a burden on us because this board's already issued an order for the Napa salt pond restoration project. And we know the extent of the project at Sears Point. It's being initiated by Sonoma Land Trust, and it will involve some levee work in there, but it's something we can, depending on the timing, we can do either through water quality certification over my signature or waste discharge requirements in front of the board. So we'll be looking at the timing on that. But it is, the nexus is that it's projects we support. So that's sort of recognizing once again the North Bay Corridor and its significance. Tam Dodick emailed me and John Mueller yesterday to say she had to miss today's meeting. Maybe she was clairvoyant a little bit. But she did send me a note saying she would like me to just highlight a few of the bills that were signed and vetoed over the past couple of weeks by the governor, since the governor now has completed the legislative session for this year with the 30-day clock expiring on October 9th. So he's taken all of his action on the legislature's bills. A few to highlight include the governor signed Senator Wolk's bill to provide statutory authority to municipalities to borrow from the state revolving fund. And this is a little bit different. It provides a little more flexibility, and I'm going to try to find out more details on how a state board is going to implement this, but this is actually providing more opportunity to municipalities to borrow for doing the work they need to do to improve their infrastructure. Governor also signed Assemblyman Wieckowski's bill that would extend the sunset date of the increased fee on gasoline for the underground storage tank cleanup fund and extends it from January 1, 2012 to January 1, 2014. And this was something that was a bit controversial, getting into all the issue about fees versus taxes, but it's very clear that the tank cleanup fund has been running out of money and it needs this extension of the fee. So that was good to see. That was signed. He also signed Assemblyman Smythe's bill that authorizes the state board to close underground tank sites upon petition when those sites have been under the jurisdiction of a local implementing agency and that they've been open for more than 5 years. This has been a contentious issue for a long time because we've even found that there are many of the local agencies that tend to over-review tank sites and be very cautious about closing them. And so this provides a little more opportunity for the state board to say we feel that's been enough has been done here and we can move forward and close the site. A couple of vetoes. One, you may recall discussion at the WQCC on the groundwater session about the Pavley bill that would make well completion reports public but limit that accessibility to a certain number of professionals. And the governor vetoed that bill, saying that he felt that limitation to that list of specified professionals was too limited, that these reports needed to be more broadly available and directed Department of Water Resources to work with the legislature on coming up with a more broad based approach. And you recall from WQCC that this has been a fireworks. I think this was one of the three, whatever it was, three nuclear bomb ratings from the presenter there. So this will certainly be, over the next legislative session, a significant issue of discussion. And I think it pushes, and further in his veto message, he recognized that the state does not have a good groundwater management system in place. And so I think it raises the profile of that issue, and it's good that the governor does recognize that. And hopefully in the next legislative session, there's going to be progress made on that.
If I can interrupt for a second, I've told a couple of people who are non-water policy wonks that we are the only state now west of the Mississippi, basically, that does not have groundwater regulation in place, and even Texas is ahead of us, and that elicits quite a response. It's very interesting. may have turned the tide there.
Another veto of Assemblyman Garrick's bill that would have exempted licensed civil engineers from having to satisfy any training or experience requirements relative to the preparation of stormwater pollution prevention plans that's required under the State Board's construction stormwater permit. And the veto message said that governor felt that this was inefficient to just call out certain professionals that would be exempt from this training, but in the message called upon state board to review the requirements, the training and education requirements, to ensure that they were effective and efficient. And so I think it's good that the governor is, or at least the governor's office, is recognizing the significance of the stormwater regulations and the need to ensure that they're both efficient and effective. So those are some of the bills that have come out. State Board, Rob Eagle usually does a summary of all the bills that affect the State Board system, and he'll have that available this month, and we'll share that with you. Last month I noted during the introduction session that we didn't have any introductions, but that we were in the process of doing some promotions because we'd given the okay to do that, and so I'm happy to report we've been able to go through interviews and announce that we're going to promote David Elias to senior geologist, section leader in the Groundwater Protection Division, and promote Claudia Villacorta to section leader, senior engineer in the NPDES section, where we have another promotion pending, some paperwork issues up in Sacramento, so we'll hope to make another announcement next month on a promotion. And also, since last month, we're happy that we've gotten the word that State Board has received an exemption to the hiring freeze that the governor has in place. Relatively limited, we're being allowed to hire two positions, so we're putting together an announcement for both engineer and environmental scientist, but we also have to look at how we balance that with potentially increasing the time bases of certain people on staff who've made that request. We would view it as being able to get more work out of people on staff is more efficient than bringing new people in from outside. So we're trying to do the balance of that. Also this week, Marta Lafer, who had been a longtime engineer, first with the State Board and then with us working on Marin County issues, she is retired. So that's both sad to see her retire, but that provides an opportunity for hiring and a bit of a challenge for us to cover the work she's been doing over all of her time. So,
Bruce, how many current vacant positions do we have, and have we lost some as the years have gone by and cuts have made their way through the system?
We have lost quite a number. In fact, in the early 2000s, our overall staffing was up in the 140s, and now we're down at about 105 area. So we've essentially done that through attrition. The challenge as the system, the state system, always works is an attempt to recognize that there's going to be vacancies in the system, so that for a long time we got 95% of our funding for 100% of our positions, figuring that 5% would be vacant. The year before last, the governor said, well, let's up that to 10%, hold up back 10%. And the way they have managed that was saying, well, it's easier to manage at 5%, so we're going to take 5% of your vacant positions, just take those away, and then we'll manage it at sort of the 5% level. So that means we had, prior to Marla's retirement, we had 7 vacancies with a little over 100 staff, so the State Board did the math and say that means you can hire 2 people and preserve 5 positions as vacant to meet this 5% level. We're faced, obviously, with the challenge of having probably a limited window to do hiring from outside, because I would fully expect that, if not sooner, at least by the time the governor releases his budget for the next fiscal year, which he will do the second week of January, I think all the revenue projections are, you know, yeah, scary, to say the least. And he'll probably have further messages on how we're going to address that moving forward in terms of state personnel. The flip side is that, and as you heard up at the WQCC, with the state board's adoption of a new fee schedule, more of our positions that had been historically funded from the general fund have been moved into fees. Certainly the regulated community isn't happy about that, but that does limit the number of positions to, at this point, less than 10% of our positions are general funded. We've tended to be sort of wrapped up with all of the discussion about limiting hiring, even though we essentially are funded now largely by fees, cost recovery, and federal funding, albeit the federal funding is getting some cuts too. So we're doing sort of a juggling act, you know, keeping as many balls in the air to try to see how many staff we can both keep and promote, but recognizing as we promote, unless we're able to hire from outside, we essentially take a high-performing line staff, promote them. They're going to be a great supervisor, but then we have fewer people at the line level doing the work. So we're doing a balancing act there, and we know we anticipate a few more retirements over the course of this year. The challenge there is even when somebody says we're retiring today, they may have leave on the books that needs to be cashed out, so we're not able to hire, you know, immediately. It sort of has to pay for that cash out portion to it. So there's a lot of moving pieces in this. We're trying to be as bullish as we can to keep quote unquote fully staffed, but the reality is I looked back and we're essentially funded at the level we were in 92-93, and I would say the things we're required to do that has grown almost exponentially over the last 20 years, and we're trying to do it with essentially the same level of staffing. So that's why it's unfortunate at one level, because having to continue all today's items means that's staff time spent on that, and not only staff time for that, but your time too. So that's tied into the fact that we do hear that with the legislative session, the bill session being over, that the governor's office is going to put more attention to making appointments, especially for water boards.
We're optimistic.
Yeah, and state boards, so, you know, potentially. But we've been hearing that for some time, so you know, all we can do is look at the press releases as they come out or don't come out.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Bruce, may I make a comment there? You mentioned Marla Lafer, and before I was a board member here, I had the pleasure of working pretty closely with her as a consultant on 401 issues in Marin County. And I think, you know, and like Brian Wines, who has found ways to become more efficient and, you know, provide templates and make our process more efficient and meet the challenge of funding, you know, under 1992 conditions on that program. She was an innovator in pulling together kind of a pre-application process where she would bring in Fish and Game, the county reps, sometimes the Corps of Engineers, believe it or not, and help applicants understand the 401 process. So that took extra effort, you know, and it feels these days like a luxury. But I would submit that kind of effort, depending on the location and the efficiencies, but it actually makes us more efficient in the long run, because the applications that come in are there's not as much back and forth. So I want to recognize, you know, we recognize Johnson Lamb and his innovations when he retired earlier this year. For my part, I'd like to recognize Marla Lafer's innovations, and you know, she pioneered some important work in my corner of the region, and I would be remiss not to mention that and to give my sincere appreciation for her service.
Definitely. Thank you. I also wanted to touch on a couple of events. You've commented on State of the Estuary, WQCC, RMP annual meeting. I do want to highlight that after the WQCC that evening, I met up with John Muller to present the Tang Chung Wu Pollution Prevention Award, physically present it to the City Council of the City of Millbrae. And it was great to have an opportunity to not only celebrate city staff's effort in pollution prevention, but reinforce the importance of it to the City Council. The item right after our presentation was a presentation by Ed Harrington, the Executive Director of San Francisco PUC, on PUC's water system improvement project. And his presence there gave me an opportunity to note that San Francisco PUC was a past winner of the Pollution Prevention Award, and maybe remind him that the San Francisco program is active in pollution prevention, and raise the profile there. So that was a good opportunity, and definitely kudos to John Mueller for being there, because it was his granddaughter's birthday, so he ran off to do that afterwards. And last week I noted in the report that last week Alexis Strauss and I were part of a workshop presenting the private sewer lateral ordinance that the Stege Sanitary District is implementing. This follows on the heels of workshops that we attended for Piedmont and Emeryville, part of the whole East Bay community's effort to address the sanitary sewer overflows, the wet weather infiltration inflow issues that East Bay Mud and the communities are tasked to address. But I think it's significant in that we are seeing and sort of developing a model for taking private sewer lateral ordinances more broadly. Already Albany, Alameda, Berkeley had ordinances in place. This effort with Oakland, soon to be rolled out, will get the whole East Bay Mud sewer shed covered. And these ordinances not only address the need for inspection and repair at time of property transfer, but when significant remodel is being done and when there's a change in water use, such as addition of a bathroom or something like that. And so this has been a real hot button, especially to the real estate community, for a number of years. And we know that there have been some statewide attempts, and in some portions of the state they say, gee, you know, leaky laterals really isn't a high priority for us in the high desert or something like that. But I think this provides a model and, to a certain degree, some cover for the sanitary agencies to move these forward. And I did have the opportunity last Friday to speak to the North Bay Watershed Association. They've, in Marin and Sonoma counties, they've been wrestling with this issue over private sewer laterals, and they were very interested to hear me tell about the models in the East Bay, because they want to see what they can pursue on that. So I think there's progress definitely being made, not only on the whole East Bay Mud sewer shed, but on this effort of how the public needs to step up to the plate and recognize that, one, that they have private sewer laterals, because most do not know that, and two, that they need to maintain them, and that maintenance is imperative in protecting the bay's water quality. With that, that sort of wraps what I would like to report on. I think that's probably all we can sort of touch on today. I will note, pending, you know, any new appointments, we're going to continue to be very tight in terms of being able to have a quorum. I know Shalom will not be able to attend in November, so take your flu shots and all of this, and see if we can all stay well, and then continue to have a quorum for future meetings. So
sign up for your vacations early, because we can't all do it at once.